then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's June the 2nd, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon.
The first thing I'd like to do this week is to thank all the comrades who attended our Memorial Day barbecue here in the Pugetopolis. Some of you folks came all the way from Oregon, which I appreciate. It was really great seeing you all again. Secondly, although I know this will set the goat dancers to whirling like dervishes again on Facebook and on their pseudo-intellectual blogs that have even fewer readers than ours, if that's possible, I need to mention at this point that it doesn't look like Axis Sally is going to be able to make it this week. Now, like most people, she has to work for a living, and she's reported a scheduling conflict that she can't get out of, and so she might not be able to make it up to our secret recording studio here in the bunker, which is guarded by the special SS Sasquatch division. Of course, this means that immediately the internet loons will begin to cackle, "I knew she was really a voice modulator robot!" No, really. I know some of you probably didn't believe us last week, but there are, in fact, some morons out there on the internet who really are claiming that this lady is some kind of robot or software program I'm using to convince people that we can get women into the Northwest movement. Just like they claim repeatedly that other very real people are actually me under another name and email address. They claim that they know this because these other people, quote-unquote, write so well, and only Harold can write that well. No, I'm not joking. I am always rather bemused to learn that apparently I'm the only person in the movement who can string a few correct and grammatical sentences together. Anyway, the story is that I'm supposed to have all these internet aliases, this secret army of flying monkeys on the internet, kind of like the Wicked Witch of the West. It makes these paranoid obsessives really look like fools when they start seeing Harold under every bed and behind every tree, and accusing very real people of not existing, but they never seem to get that. I've noticed this about goat dancers. They're so wrapped up in their obsession that they honestly seem to have no idea how all of this looks to other people. Now, some people really, really have too much time on their hands. Okay, now to the emails. This is from Rocky in Houston. Dear HAC, did you see where the Texas State Legislature was going to pass a law criminalizing these invasive body searches being carried out by TSA agents at the airports? But when the FAA threatened to shut down the airports and prohibit any air traffic in and out of Texas, they folded like a lawn chair. Yeah, Rocky, I saw that. So much for this hope that some of us have for so-called state sovereignty movements. There are those among us who keep pointing out various state legislature laws and statements by Western governors about how they ain't going to let the federal government do this, and they ain't going to let the FBI and the BATFE do this, and they're going to legalize all guns, and they're going to go back to the gold and silver standard, and they're going to nullify federal law and all this horse hockey. Guys, it would be nice if it was true, but it isn't. It's just posturing for the Tea Party, and maybe because somebody's looking for votes to run for a higher office. It's not real, and if it ever came down to the point where these men actually had to defy the federal government at gunpoint, they'd shit in their expensive silk underwear in terror. and they'd back down so fast it would make your head spin. Yeah, I'm old enough to remember when Governor George Wallace of Alabama stood in the door to prevent integration of the state university and the admission of a nigger. It was all posturing, the 1960s equivalent of a soundbite. I also remember that once the television cameras were turned off, Wallace stepped aside and let the nigger in. He wasn't going to defy a federal court order. That might have gotten him in trouble. And remember, white boys must never, ever get in trouble. Now, you may remember that we talked about this a while back on Radio Free Northwest when all this rhetoric was coming out of the state houses in Idaho and Wyoming and Montana, and I urged caution at that time. I said, let's see what happens when the regime actually puts its foot down. Well, now we know. The federal government put their foot down over this airport nudity and sexual molestation in airports thing. Now, this whole groping business is, of course, designed to force people to walk through the naked body scanners. So, among other things, like fingerprints and DNA, the United States and its various secret police agencies are now accumulating databases of nude pictures of Americans. And no doubt they'll have to hire all kinds of new bureaucrats to examine all these nude pictures closely, especially the women, looking for Arabic tattoos or swastikas or whatever. Apparently, the Obama regime has decided that this is something important that they must have. So they put their foot down, and the mighty state of Texas, for all their big talk and their 10-gallon Stetsons and their yippee-ki-yay-yays, crumpled like a styrofoam cup when Obama said boo, or more accurately, when their money was threatened. Guys, please remember that Western legislators and governors in places like Idaho and Montana and Utah and Wyoming and Alaska are not white racial revolutionaries or even true conservatives. They're simply capitalists and businessmen, chamber of commerce types, ordinary Republican conservatives at best. And like all conservatives, they're not concerned about race, they're concerned about money, their money. They're not even concerned with the Constitution so much, except insofar as they think it can be used to prevent Obama from taking any more of their money in the form of taxes and regulation. And by the way, in some of these cases, the liberals have some of it right. Some of these right-wing capitalist bastards in the state house and their corporate paymasters really do want to rape the land and the environment for money. So let's not hold our breaths expecting anything to come out of all their swaggering and chest beating and all this hokey from a bunch of Republican backbenchers and state legislatures out here in the West. They're not in it for the white race or for the American spirit or anything like that. They're in it for their bank accounts and their corporate sponsors. Now, you would think that after 8 years of Jug Ears Bush and his little Jewish friends, we'd know better than to trust any Republican. But I have to admit, Obama and the Democrats have been so god-awful that 2 years on, they actually make us dream of that drunken little jug-eared leprechaun and that gargoyle Dick Cheney with nostalgia. Okay, next email from John in New Jersey. Dear HAC, what do you say to this naysay that the Pacific Northwest is full of liberals? Well, I've gone over this before, but I'm happy to give it a spaced repetition. Now, that generalization is by no means true. First off, we need to define the term full of. What exactly do we mean by the term full of liberals? Now, do you mean that the news media and the political establishment is as red as a London double-decker bus? Well, true. I can see how parts of the Northwest might look that way to outsiders. Yes, Oregon and Washington are blue states, although Idaho and Montana are red states, if that means anything. Now, we do have a Democrat governor in Washington who was elected by an especially egregious example of vote fraud some years ago, and we haven't been able to get rid of her since. My old congressman from down in Astoria is a Democrat, of course, an Asian named David Wu, who seems to be clinically insane. Now, the last I heard, his own staff had revolted against him, and the men in the white coats were chasing this guy through the halls of Congress with butterfly nets. No joke. I think at the moment he's on some kind of congressional leave of absence in a nice quiet cackle box. And every time there's a vote, they get this gook all medicated and they trot him out to back up whatever atrocity Obama and the Democrats are perpetrating now. Wu campaigned in 2010 for re-election wearing weird Chuck E. Cheese type animal costumes. He babbled dementedly in public speeches and he sent weird emails to his constituents and his campaign staff about his lust for young girls. But that didn't stop them from campaigning for him, and that didn't stop those turkeys on Oregon's north coast from re-electing him, presuming the votes were counted honestly, which is something you can never assume anymore these days anywhere. Anyway, yeah, I can see how some people might believe that the Northwest is quote-unquote full of liberals, but that's not exactly the case. Seattle and Portland and Eugene and Salem, and to a much lesser extent some of the larger urban areas, are indeed quote-unquote full of liberals in the sense that they have small activist minorities who've taken over the city and state governments and bureaucracies in their area. They control the media, of course, like liberals do everywhere, and they control the academic world. Now, they use their control of state and local government and university funds and so forth and so on to give their own kind patronage jobs, and that makes large numbers of people economically dependent on them in the cities where there are millions of voters, most of the minorities, who are dependent on Democrat rule for their welfare checks and their handouts, as opposed to the rural areas and small towns, which are still 98% white and full of normal working Americans. Anyway, bingo, you've got a blue state. But I repeat, only two out of the four, or five if you count Wyoming, which is also a red state. Now, once you get outside the cities along the left coast, I mean along the I-5 corridor, you will see rifle racks and even a few Confederate flags on the pickup trucks, and you'll see a whole nother Northwest. And I'm not just talking about over the Cascade Mountains. I'm talking about on the left coast itself, outside those three or four large urban areas. Kurt Cobain, the famous grunge rocker, came from a little town called Aberdeen. In fact, we passed through it the other day. And he used to complain about all the rednecks in Aberdeen, Washington that wouldn't let him be free to plunk on his guitar and blow his dope and, you know, sexually molest moose in the woods or whatever it was Cobain was up to in Aberdeen. Anyway, Cobain fled to Seattle and eventually blew his brains out with a shotgun. Either that or that Jew wife of his had him whacked. I think there's some doubt about that. And I'm rambling again. Anyway, we concentrated one of our primary settlement areas in the Puget Sound area because it's economically rich and because it has a massive amount of economic activity and jobs. But believe me, Seattle and Portland are not the entire Northwest, nor do they speak for the entire Northwest. A lot of normal white people live here, and that includes the cities. Now, the biggest radio station in Seattle is KTTH, and that's the talk radio station that carries Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and all the other conservative talk show hosts, including, unfortunately, Jews like Michael Medved, who I think lives here. Well, I never said Seattle was perfect. Anyway, that one station, KTTH, is just about the only radio station in Seattle that's not having financial problems right now because they have the biggest listenership in the city. It's like all the millions of normal white people who live in upstate New York, but who are totally outweighed and overshadowed by New York City. Now, these five or six big cities are totally unrepresentative of the true Northwest. Now, if you want to learn about the real Northwest, you should go out into the countryside in the small towns and meet the actual people who do all the work and make their lives here. I keep telling people when they come here as immigrants, they'll probably have to go to one of the larger cities because that's where the jobs are. But if you do have skills or your own business, believe me, if you can make it out into the countryside here economically in one of these rural areas, you're in for a treat because it's really nice. In fact, Axis Sally and I were in a little bar in Centralia a while back, and it had live entertainment. Anyway, they had some Eastern European immigrant type up on the stage doing a kind of a country music act, believe it or not. Anyway, this is what Sally recorded on her phone.
Can be free.
You must grab him by his horns.
Okay, so maybe I exaggerated that last story a bit, but you get the idea. No kidding, guys. Don't judge the whole Northwest by Seattle and Portland. Read the Northwest novels, and you'll get some idea about how that situation can be dealt with when the time comes. It's not insurmountable, believe me. I don't want to get into things that might lead the FBI agents and whatnot that are listening to this to perk up their ears, but let me put it this way. Seattle and Portland liberals don't have the stomach to lead the kind of life that the people of Belfast had to lead for 30 years. And if and when things get really proactive in the Northwest, those big cities are going to get a lot less liberal real quick. Right. Now, I got a heckle on one of the blogs from some kind of Jew or leftist. Not sure exactly what he was, but he was very upset about my playing that cut a while back on gay history, which some of you may recall. Anyway, he ranted and raved at me that I was degrading all kinds of minority people, I'm an ignoramus, and all kinds of minorities really did help in settling this great country of ours, blah, 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 blah. I won't say yada, 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 because somebody objected to that last time I said it, but... Okay, look, I don't deny that there were blacks and Mexicans and Indians and women in America's history, although most of the women were by no means feminist heroes, like that teenage girl whose name escapes me, Mary something, I think. Anyway, she was kidnapped in 1701 or thereabouts from Deerfield, Massachusetts in colonial times by Indians, and she and her smaller sister were taken to the Indian camp and gang-raped. The girl subsequently then escaped by cutting the throats of several of the Indians while they slept, and she stole a canoe along with her much younger sister. She got them both back to civilization, and then she led an armed column of white soldiers and settlers back to the Indian camp, who then proceeded to slaughter them all. Not exactly a politically correct American heroine, any more than Mary Chestnut Boykin of the South or Calamity Jane out in the West were politically correct. But look, I have no problems with minorities in history, so long as it's accurate and truthful. For example, did you know that there were Jewish cowboys in the Old West? Now, you could always tell who they were because they sang Yippee Oy Vey. There was even a famous Jewish gunfighter who had a Western ballad written about him.
The Ballad of Irving. He was short and fat and rode out of the west with a Mogan David on his silver vest. He was mean and nasty right clear through, which was kind of weird because he was yellow too. They called him Irving. Big Irving. Big Short Irving. Big Short Fat Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the west. Irving. He came from the old bar mitzvah spread with a 10-gallon yarmulke on his head. He always followed his mother's wishes. Even on the range, he used two sets of dishes. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sissy Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Irving. 141 could draw faster than he, but Irving was looking for 143. Walked in a salt saloon like a man insane and ordered three fingers of 2 cents plain. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sport Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Irving. One day, Bad Max happened in the town. His aim was to shoot Fat Irving down. Bad Max said, draw and draw right now. And Irving drew a picture of a cow. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Gunfighter Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Irving. The James boys was coming on a train at first sun, and the town said, Irving, we need your gun. Well, that train pulled in at the break of dawn. Irving's gun was there, but Irving was gone. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big help Irving. the 142nd fastest gun in the West. Well, finally, Irving got three slugs in the belly. It was right outside the Frontier Deli. He was sitting there twirling his gun around, and Butterfingers Irving gunned himself down.
Irving,
big fat Irving,
big dum-dum Irving,
big dum-dum dead Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Really?
Got another email from a guy that I won't name because I believe he's sincere in his racial nationalism. Dumb, but sincere. We get a lot of that. And I don't want him to think that I'm trying to publicly dress him down or read him the riot act, as I mentioned a few weeks ago. But once again, the attitude that this comrade has about some things is, in fact, a fairly common one. And this topic will continue to come up again from time to time. Anyway, he sent me an email to the effect of, "Hey, Harold, when is the Northwest Front gonna do something? You know, stand on the street corner wearing funny-looking costumes, and holding signs and letting all kinds of scum pelt you with garbage, and letting the police take your pictures and the media, too, so they can come to your house and upset your children and everybody loses their jobs and gets evicted from their homes for being racist. You know, when are you gonna do something?" In other words, when is the NF going to quit fooling around with all this building infrastructure stuff and go back to the old ways, those old ways that have brought us such wonderful success so far for the past 50 years? The tragedy is that a lot of movement groups who do start out, like ours, with the right idea of covert organizing and laying the groundwork for revolutionary political activity first, end up wandering back to the old ways, or possibly getting dragged back to them would be a better way to describe it, out of nothing more or less than a pure lack of imagination. The long and complex and difficult job of building a support system and building an infrastructure and slowly acquiring necessary plant and skills and slowly getting people situated just gets too boring and too hard after a while. Americans have a very short attention span as it is, and people start saying, come on, fearless leader, let's quit screwing around and let's do something. And more often than not, fearless leader gives in and does the wrong thing. He reverts to the old silly ways of making public spectacles out of our weakness, and then bang goes another serious effort. All you've got left is another little movement clusterfuck, which usually falls apart after a while because there's nothing underpinning it. Or it could be just the opposite. Sometimes the gotta-do-something syndrome can result from enthusiasm rather than boredom or disillusionment. Now, you get a few people together and they start getting their morale and their courage perked up by actually associating with other racially aware white people, and they get all excited and they start saying, "We gotta do something, gotta do something, gotta jump up and down and shit snowballs. Doesn't matter what, just so long as we do something. Who knows, maybe even we can get on TV for 15 seconds, wow, and that way we'll know that we're real." You get the idea. I mentioned some months ago a comrade in northern Idaho who developed a pretty bad case of the gotta-do-something bug. He made a Ku Klux Klan snowman, and that got him into the papers and on TV, and I guess he developed a taste for the limelight. Anyway, last December, I think it was, he and three or four buddies dressed up in some costumes that were supposed to resemble Aryan Nations outfits, I think. I don't know. I didn't see them. And these guys picketed a Mexican taco stand, of all things. And yeah, they did manage to get a few column inches in the local paper and about 30 seconds of airtime on the local news. And then along comes January 17th of this year, and they find the bionic backpack on the streets of Spokane, right where the local Martin Luther Coon parade was supposed to pass by. Or at least the FBI says they did. By this allegedly highly sophisticated bomb in a backpack, which was in fact so highly sophisticated that it supposedly had wires sticking out of it, was allegedly spotted on a park bench by what were described by the media as three quote-unquote sharp-eyed city workers, who turned out in fact to be three temps from Labor Ready who'd been dragged in that morning to sweep the streets or whatever. Now, I've worked for Labor Ready myself in the past when I was really desperate. And just between you and me and the FBI monitors, I suspect that what happened was that those three guys were rifling through the backpack looking for something that they could hop to buy a bottle of Thunderbird. Anyway, guess whose was the first driveway that the squad cars rolled up into? You guessed it. Our friend who wanted to play dress up and wave a sign at a taco stand. You see, when he did that, he made the list of usual suspects. Or I should say the cop's list of usual suspects. I got my own list of usual suspects, but they don't wear costumes, they use false name and post horse manure on the internet. You really, really don't want to be on the cop's list of usual suspects for anything racial. Because, you see, cops think that we're like homos or vampires, and we're all involved in one big, huge conspiracy, and we all know each other. And we all know everything that one another does. Don't I wish. God, I wish we were one-tenth as well-organized and well-supplied and well-financed as you see on TV and Hollywood movies. Anyway, when you're a usual suspect, every time some idiot redecorates the local synagogue or whatever, your driveway is the first one to hit the bubblegum machine, because that's part of the standard police drill when they don't have any actual evidence. They go around to anyone they think, rightly or wrongly, may know something, and they try to squeeze and harass and threaten information out of that person. Doesn't matter whether the information is any good or not, just so long as they can write a report and say, yes, I spoke to so-and-so and so-and-so, and here's the, you know, the information that I got. That's what local cops call investigating. There is another danger as well, and that is if they don't know whoever did whatever it was, they may well try to frame you for it. Now, what you have to understand is that from the system's point of view, in so-called hate crimes, an immediate arrest is absolutely essential because they know that one of the three legs of the revolutionary tripod I've spoken about before is the loss of the credible monopoly of armed force, or even the credible ability to punish dissent, and they can't afford to lose that in the eyes of the white community. Now, this is why so many white people convicted of hate crimes have, in fact, been the victims of police and FBI fabrication. Because in the eyes of the power structure, there has to be immediate and visible punishment to maintain this legend that the system is invincible and any resistance at all, even symbolic resistance with a spray paint can, is futile. I think that's one of the reasons we see so many TV shows showing these brilliant FBI teams, especially FBI, you know, things like 24 and Criminal Minds and so forth, and they're using all this fancy technology and these predator drone spy cameras in the sky, and they've always got some little girl behind a computer like Chloe O'Brien or Penelope Garcia who can just tap a tap a tap, and all of a sudden all of the information that you ever want to know about anybody just magically appears. And obviously, it's just futile and pointless to try and resist a system with such resources at its command. Why, they know what you had for breakfast this morning. They're probably looking at you even now. They probably got a microphone in your sugar bowl, and they're watching you through your computers. Okay, I think a lot of the stuff we see from Hollywood and TV is intended to generate that kind of paranoia. Now, I know it's hard to believe that our beloved lords and masters and the steroid-pumped muscle men they use as enforcers, honest to God, don't care whether or not they have the right person. But it happens all the time, especially when there are political ramifications, as there are in so-called hate crimes. All a lot of detectives care about is their clearance rate, and how it looks on their annual performance review, and how that affects their raise. And nothing puts a little gold star on some detective's personnel jacket quicker than a fast hate crime arrest. Letting the police know who we are is just plain dumb. It is to be avoided at all costs whenever possible. Okay, I get that sometimes it happens accidentally. And I also understand that if we're ever to get into local organizing in a proper way, it will be inevitable that the local fuzz and the feds are going to know who the local NF leader is in each area. If for no other reason, then the local unit leader will eventually have to do media interviews, and that's going to give them somebody to watch and somebody to wiretap and somebody to harass. It's going to go with the job. But that is his job, and it's part of the risk a local organizer takes. And that's why he will need that support system, the other 5 or 6 members of his party cell, to provide him with a support system he needs to function, to make sure that if he loses his job in his apartment, he isn't run out of town. This is another reason why the bulk of that cell needs to keep their identities unknown to the local enforcers, if at all possible. Unless, of course, you really do have a yen for the limelight and you want to be a unit leader, you should try and keep a low profile and avoid being identified by the system's local thugs. Now, that does not mean pull your head into your shell like a tortoise and hide. One of the reasons that the system uses institutional terror, and in extreme cases they use fabricated legal frame-ups, as with Edgar Steele and Kevin Harpham, is to try and frighten us into silence. And allowing yourself to be intimidated into silence and complete inactivity is just as bad as dressing up in a costume and standing on a street corner with a sign saying, "Take me, I'm yours." There are all kinds of things that even a lone individual can do on his own in order to organize for the Northwest Republic, and I'll be getting into some of those in the next segment of this episode of Radio Free Northwest. Right now, though, we're going to hear from one of our local success stories on Northwest migration. And many of you have recommended that we publicize such stories, and so here's Mac.
Hello, fellow listeners of Radio Free Northwest. My name is Mac. This message goes to all of those who have yet to come home, especially those who are single. The message is this: it can be done. Stop the excuses. It's time to come home. My story begins in 1999. I was living in southeast New Mexico. I had been for 6 years. Amongst the Mexicans, drug dealers, gangbangers, poor economy, poor job situation. I wasn't particularly racially aware at the time. I had never heard of the Northwest Imperative or Northwest Migration. I knew that whites were different than everybody else. I knew that we were better than everybody else. And I could see that in my fellow whites in the areas that I lived and the non-whites. I could see that our lifestyles were different, our standards were different, our morals were different. And I knew I'd been sick of it, and it was time to get out. Over time, I had developed a relationship online with a young woman up in the Northwest. I had years of experience in aviation, and I knew that the Northwest was where I needed to go. It's where aviation was. In the back of my mind, I knew it was wider up here. But I had to get to the Northwest. So this young woman that I had a relationship with online helped me out by sending me newspaper clippings, phone book clippings, want ads, job ads. And I started sending my resume out in the mail and making phone calls. I eventually had landed phone interviews with a company for a particular job. And after a few calls, they said I had the job. All I had to do was move to Washington and fill out some paperwork. And the job was mine. Great. The relationship with the young woman had been going along. She had actually come down to New Mexico to visit me once. I could go up and live with her. She was happy with that. Great. So I took all the possessions that I could live without, and I put them in a storage unit for $20 a month. I paid a year in advance, knowing that it would take me a while before I could start sending them payments. And with $800 to my name, I loaded my beat-up old Texas farm truck with the rest of my goods, and I hit the road. Sent a letter to my, went into my job that I was working and told them, thanks for the job, but I need to get out of New Mexico, I'm moving. On the way up, my truck broke down. I drove a long ways from New Mexico all the way up into Washington. I hit Pullman. And coming up the big hill out of Pullman into the Palouse, my front U-joint seized up, which caused my transmission to burn out. And I drove in first gear with my front U-joint snapping roll pins from Pullman to Spokane. I was great. Now I got a broke-down truck. But it's okay. I've got a job. and I got a place to live. So I get up to Spokane, unload my stuff into the young woman's garage, take my truck to a shop, and they say, well, transmission's fried, and your front U-joints tore up, and you need to get them rebuilt. And I said, go for it. So then I went to the aircraft company that had said I had a job. All I had to do was fill out some paperwork. I get there, and I say, hi, I'm here for the job. They said, sorry, we gave it to somebody else. Great. Now I don't even have a job. No problem. I got a place to live. I can look for another job. So I start looking for another job. Young lady tells me, in the time that it took you to get here, I changed my mind. Apparently she had found somebody else. She offered to buy an airline ticket so that I could fly down and live with my mother in California. No, I'm not going to do that. I need to be in the Northwest. Didn't know why, but in my gut, I knew I needed to be in the Northwest. So I went back to that aircraft company and I said, I need a job. You promised me that job. Now I don't have a job. Soon, I won't have a place to live. I will be homeless. I need a job. We negotiated, we talked, and I got a job out of them. Part-time, minimum wage, driving a gas truck, washing airplanes. Sure, it was menial labor, way below where my skill levels were, but it was a job. It got me money. Took only a couple of paychecks, and I was able to get a place of my own. I needed to be able to pay to get my truck out of the shop. So I found a cheap apartment within walking distance of work, and I started paying to get my truck out. Winter comes along, and the aircraft company told me, well, we don't have as much work for you, so we're going to have to lay you off. Now I got no job. Fortunately, my mom had been kind enough to help me out with several hundred dollars to help me get my truck out of hock, and I was able to drive it and use it. But I had no job. I had a place of my own and bills to pay, but I needed income. So I hit the road again, pounding the pavement as hard as I could, went to other aircraft companies, handed them my resumes, gave them a list of my experience, my skills. Within a week, I had another job, this time as a full-fledged mechanic, making much better pay full-time. Then I met another young lady here, and we developed a relationship. 9/11 comes along, now I have no job. Since I didn't have a A&P certification, the bottom dropped out of the aviation business. Aircraft were grounded. Nobody was flying. They laid me off. Sorry, we don't have work for you. Well, that's just great. But I've got a place to live, and I've got some help. And at this point, I still wasn't racially aware, per se. I mean, deep inside, I knew there were differences, but I wouldn't be what you would call a racist, just a realist. Over time, I got more certifications, got more education, got into IT. The lady and I, we moved in together, and her job changed, and we ended up moving to the west side of the state. But I stayed here in Washington. I didn't chicken out and run. Times were tough. I got another job, eventually. Ended up getting some real good jobs. Then I lost them because, well, I'm just not politically correct. I know what a faggot is, I know what a nigger is, I know what a spick is, and I will call them that when I need to. So, I lose my job. But now, it's been quite a few years since I first came up here in 1999. I have my own business. I am an independent business owner. I set my hours. I have good customers. Fortunately, most of them are white. Occasionally, I have to deal with someone who is not white. But in being a business owner, that's something that's kind of necessary for the moment. I'm polite. I'm curt, but I'm polite. I get their business done and I get them out my door. I make friends with the white folk. We're doing well. The point of this is, it doesn't matter how many trials and tribulations you have to go through, you can do this. Why? Because you're white. You're white and you know it. One thing I have learned, having traveled around the world and studying people, is the fundamental difference between whites and non-whites can be summed up into a couple of words. Initiative and courage. It takes initiative and courage to do anything. You can move here. You can get your jobs here. You can get your education here. All it takes is initiative and courage. And you can do it. We will help you. We can get you links to websites. We can get you clippings. Whatever it takes to help you move here, we can do that. That's what we're here for. That is what the Northwest Front is here for. To help you move here. We recently had a comrade move out here in a couple of weeks. They had two jobs. It didn't take long. Now we've got another comrade that just moved out here from back east, far back east, all the way from the other coast. They've only been here a couple of days. They're out pounding the pavement right now, as I speak, putting out job applications, sending out resumes. He's going to have a job in a couple of weeks. Guaranteed. It can be done. Initiative and courage. Are you courageous? Then take the initiative, contact us, find out whatever it is that you need, and get your butts out here. It's time to stop the excuses. It's time to come home. Thank you for listening to me.
You know, it strikes me that I haven't gone medieval on your ass recently, so here's a hot little number from the Top of the Pops back in the 13th century. It's called Dumpate. And in this modern version, it sounds kind of like medieval disco music. This is Codex Calixtanus.
Thank you.
Okay, let's return again for the fifth or sixth time to the question of local organizing for the Northwest Front. Every week I get emails and sometimes letters and phone calls asking, "What can we do, Harold? What can we do to help?" Well, I tell these people what they can do to help, and they see that it's hard and that it involves some element of both personal risk and personal inconvenience, and that generally shuts them up for a while. But sometimes I've quite literally gotten such communications from people that say, "Harold, Harold, tell us what we can do to help that's not hard," or words to that effect. Well, that's simple. Just stay where you are behind your computers, but post, post, post. Post the URL to the party website, if nothing else. Post it here, there, everywhere. Post to right-wing and racial sites. Post to comment sections on news articles. Post to Facebook and MySpace of Britney Spears fan sites or anywhere that young white people hang out on the internet. Anyway, all right, we're going to hit local organizing again. Now, in the past, I have made no secret of the fact that I believe someday we're going to lose the internet. I won't get into that whole subject again because I'd be here all night if I did. But if and when we lose the internet, or even if we don't anytime soon, we're still going to need small, handheld items of propaganda in order to use in personal, face-to-face, one-on-one recruiting. Now, these items need to be not only clear and convincing in their content, but they need to be professional in appearance and, if possible, they need to contain bright colors and as many pictures as possible. Now, one good example would be the coffee mugs and beer mugs and t-shirts and whatnot that can be ordered from our storefront section on the party website at northwestfront.org. I order a lot of these, and I give away NVA coffee mugs and beer mugs all the time as presents, and so should you be doing. Now, those of you who've received your intro packets from the party box in Seattle will be aware of the fact that we do include a number of 1- and 2-page leaflets in the intro pack, as well as a business card or two. Now, these leaflets in the intro pack are all there for a specific reason, in that they all cover some topic or idea that I think needs to be covered with new people, and in some cases serving as an introduction to ideas that they may never have come into contact with before. The leaflet, for example, on "Why Are the Jews Persecuted?" Now, I actually have those leaflets here in front of me now, and as I said, all of them have a specific purpose in being in the introductory pack, and they're quite good as far as they go, but they all have a similar problem that might make them not quite as suitable as they might be for public distribution. Now, these leaflets are in black and white, and they consist mostly of text, and only one of them has any kind of picture on it. Now, these days, that's not the best presentation possible because it's a tragic fact that a large number of white Americans in the 21st century, especially young white Americans, are functionally illiterate. Okay, they can read technically. They can read short sentences and short words. They can read traffic signs. They can read the TV guide. They can understand what they see on TV and on websites since those images are assisted by visual images and pictures. But the fact is that many Americans, especially young white boys and girls, either never learned to read properly in the public schools, or else they never had the ability to read a block of text for content. Today, the electronic screen is king. It's kind of like white people who started out inventing writing by drawing animals on the walls of caves back in the Paleolithic age are now reverting back to that primitive state of illiteracy, but instead of drawings on the cave wall, they see their pictures on electronic screens of computers and television sets now. I'm actually amazed and proud that I've gotten as many young white people to sit down and read my novels as I have done. Now, you want to know what you can do to help? Put your natural Aryan creativity to work. The party needs a whole new selection of material, small, handheld stuff, professional in appearance, brightly colored, with as many pictures as possible. Not so much for first contact, but for face-to-face, one-on-one organizing. Now, when you're talking to somebody on the street, you can't always just tell people to, "Hey, go to such and such a website." They'll forget about it, or they just won't bother. Now, you need little cards and, above all, short pamphlets and brochures that you can hand to people physically to make them stick it in their pocket and read it when they get home and then go to the website. Now, a lot of older people in the movement tend to send me their collections of stuff, you know, when they figure they're about to die, saying, "Harold, I collected these for 40 years, and now I'm passing my collection on to you." And a lot of this is really good old stuff, books, pamphlets, the sort of thing that we got our knowledge from back in the days before the internet. And the thing is, I don't keep these collections just gathering dust on my shelf. I pass them out. Anyone who comes around here knows that the first thing I ask people to do is dig through this whole huge box of old pamphlets and stuff, and I ask people, look, take what you want, but I ask that you either return it to me or pass it on when you're through with it. Don't let these books and these pamphlets sit on the shelf gathering dust. Now, we eventually are going to need a lot of small items like that, books, small pamphlets, stickers, cards, that sort of stuff. If you want to work for the Northwest Republic, you'll need these small items so you can stuff your pockets full of them, or a backpack full of stickers or cards or small half-page leaflets, whatever. And this stuff has to be not only right on the money racial content-wise and Northwest-wise, but it has to be short, punchy, simple, and attractive to simple and punchy people with short attention spans. I'd love to get some of those little tiny comic books, like the little Christian comics you find all the time scattered around in post offices and restrooms and lying on bus seats, so forth and so on, but we don't have that capability yet. Now, we do not as yet have a proper general headquarters set up for the Northwest Front. The establishment of such an institution is my own personal holy grail, but before that can happen, we're going to need boots on the ground and money. I can't attempt anything that might fail because we don't have enough of either. We cannot as yet provide a master source for these small handheld items. We have to rely on your creativity and, yes, your financing. I'll give you an example. Recently, a good supporter of ours manufactured at his own expense and sent to us several hundred iron-on and sew-on Northwest tricolor jacket patches. At one stage, one of our guys in Portland used to order and ship us 2,000 or so business cards at once, although he developed a medical situation and he's out of it now, so we need someone to take his place. Stickers, patches, tricolor knickknacks, leaflets, pamphlets, pens, baseball caps, T-shirts, all the kind of thing that Gerhard Lauck used to call toys. Small, handheld items that have the party mailing address and web address on them, as well as a short slogan or something that tells people what we're about. Ex Gladio Libertas is all very nice, for example. It's a reference to the Northwest novels. But let's face it, how many American Joe Sixpacks and Beavis and Buttheads speak Latin or would have any idea what that means? Every item we put out needs to have some kind of indication as to exactly what the NF is about. The slogan needs to be White Homeland in the Northwest or something of the kind. The basic purpose of all local organizing is yet another one of my famous three C's. You have to contact, convince, and connect other white people with the Northwest Front. We can't be constantly recycling the same old faces like the movement's been doing for the past 50 years. We have to start bringing in new people from outside our incestuous little bubble. As a local organizer, you have to identify potential white nationalists, convince them through personal discussion and also using the various aids we can give you, like the Northwest novels and the party website and all those little handheld items, pamphlets and stickers and whatnot that you're going to be making. And then you have to bring them into contact with the party itself. We'll take it from there, hopefully, and between the two of us, we will hopefully persuade your new recruit to pack the moving van and come home where he's supposed to be and where he can really get involved. Now, this is another reason why it's important for you guys to not dress up in costumes and run around on street corners waving signs and yelling, "Look at me! Look at me!" When you do that, you cease to be a normal person that other people might listen to and be convinced by. You become entertainment, and we need to get out of the entertainment industry. Ideally, we need to pick and choose our own people, and no one should ever join the party. The party should join you. But realistically, given our web presence and eventually the fact that our activism is going to attract attention here in the Northwest, there are going to be people who do come to us wanting to get involved, and you need to know how to assess potential volunteers, small v. The first thing you need to do with a potential recruit is to assess that person's potential value to the movement. Yes, to be blunt, we have to use people, and we have to look at people on the basis of what can they do for the Northwest Republic. That means you need to assess their character. And if the person is a volunteer with a small v, you need to understand precisely why they're coming forward. You need to determine the nature of their interest. I'm not talking about potential spies and enemy agents. That's a whole nother subject. I'm talking right now about apparently sincere white people who genuinely want to join in our efforts and become part of our movement. One of the first things a Northwest Front activist needs to ascertain is why. Broadly speaking, I'd say that probably the biggest human character problem we have as regards bringing in new people is that so many people come to us and seek to become involved in the movement because they want to get something out of it, not put something into it. This being early 21st century America and not early 20th century Europe, we should hardly be surprised at this. White people who come forward and place themselves at the movement's service out of nothing more or less than pure idealism are going to be very few and far between, although we do get them, and they're the most desirable kind of recruit. If you run across one of these people motivated by genuine racial idealism, then you got a real gem. But most people will want to get involved out of less pristine and much more human motives. Notice I said human motives, not necessarily bad ones. But you need to know what to look for and expect. Now, I don't have to tell you guys how the media portray us, especially how they portray National Socialists. We're violent homicidal maniacs who dress up in weird neo-Nazi uniforms and goose-step around in compounds way out in the woods that are full of automatic weapons. We rob banks and armored cars. We engage in elaborate criminal conspiracies to assassinate the president or poison the reservoirs and the ghettos with LSD. Or we have private torture chambers in our basements into which we abduct poor defenseless niggers and cute little Jewish kids with yarmulkes and gutsy, busty, beautiful female FBI agents whom we then do S&M with. I mean, you get the idea. We all need to understand that as ridiculous as this Hollywood Nazi image is, there are millions of our own people out there who believe it. And that means that there are going to be some people who will want to join us because of that very stereotype and not in spite of it. There are also people who read my books and who somehow get the idea that this is what's actually going on right now in the Northwest, that the NVA is real, and that when they join the Northwest Front, they're going to be handed a rifle or a pipe bomb and told to go kill somebody or blow something up. Now, that's the first thing you need to do when you're dealing with a potential recruit. You need to make sure that the prospect understands that this is a legal movement and we don't break the law, at least not until there's no more law left to break. And you need to immediately stifle any wild talk on his part of illegal activity. I've had people do meetings off the email contact list, and they get back to me and they tell me, "Hey, Harold, so-and-so on that list is a real kook, or else he's a cop, because he sat down in the coffee shop and immediately started babbling about making bombs and committing criminal activity." Now, it's not necessarily just police agents who do that, you know. A lot of white people honestly, passionately want to join the NVA right away and start blasting. Like all Americans, they want it all, and they want it now. And they want it either free or really cheap and with a full guarantee and warranty. I wish to hell we could accommodate them, but we can't. Real life doesn't work that way. Another phenomenon we get a lot is people, usually white men, but more recently some women as well, trying to join us because they're basically just looking for friends. Now, I get this. Believe me, I do. There is no one on earth more lonely and isolated than a racially conscious white person adrift in a seemingly endless nightmare of political correctness. It's a horrible way to live, and I think we've all been there at one time or another. After a while, you actually start questioning your own sanity. After all, you're the only one you know who seems to be aware of all these racial and political problems and all the contradictions, the tremendous gap that exists in America between what is said and what's done. You're the only one who seems to see all this insane crap going on everywhere, while everyone else around you seems to buy into it. Inevitably, you start to wonder about your own sanity. After all, if everybody else believes that whales speak French at the bottom of the sea and a giant pig eats the moon every month, then who exactly are you to say any different? If everybody else believes that all this malarkey about the races being equal and being gay is so wonderful and magical and funny, and we're all going to be coffee-colored in a number of generations, and the Jews are just wonderful little fiddlers on the roof, then maybe they're right and you're wrong. You start thinking to yourself that maybe you really are the one who's out of step. Maybe you are nuts like the majority says you are. And then you go on the internet, and you find VNN or Stormfront or NorthwestFront.org or a few other websites, and you see that, no, you're not alone. That there really are others who see the same things that you see and feel the same things that you feel. And for a lot of our people, that's enough. They join a V-Bulletin board, and they vent, they listen to podcasts, and they feel better, and they're able to make it through another day. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's an understandable and human reaction. But eventually, some people want more. They get tired of the internet, and they want to meet some other real live racists. Now, that's fine. I wish more people would feel that way. We have almost 2,200 people on our email list right now, and only about 140 of them so far are willing to list their names on the public email address list so that they can contact and physically meet with other people. I'll mention another thing. Access Sally and that nonsense last week notwithstanding, I noticed that I often get queries from single white men asking me if there are any white women involved with ENF. Now, you would be amazed at how desperate so many of these guys are just to meet a racially conscious white woman. They're so rare. Now, most of them don't care what she looks like, just so he can say nigger around her and not get a long lecture on tolerance and a threat to leave him and take the kids. Now, I sure as hell wish we could accommodate them. And sometimes I can see their faces fall in disappointment when I have to tell them that single and accessible, racially conscious white women of childbearing age are, for all practical purposes, non-existent. Now, that's another thing we're going to have to change, although God knows how. I don't blame them. There's not a damn thing wrong with wanting to find a wife. It shows the guy has healthy instincts. But your prospects need to understand from the very beginning that the movement isn't a dating service. Let me make clear that all of this is not necessarily a bar to someone becoming involved with the NF, so long as you make it clear to them from the get-go what the real situation is. But we need to think, are these people really going to turn out to be the Class A's, the Northwest Volunteers, in the kind of environment we have now? Now, the thing is that the party is not and cannot be a pen pal society or an internet club or a social networking site. We have Facebook for that. Third music break. I've gotten a number of requests down through the months to see if I could locate some of the old Rockwell-era Hate Nanny recordings from the 1950s. I was finally able to find one. It's an old classic called Ship Those Niggers Back, which I had to pull off YouTube, but the music and the lyrics are still pretty understandable. If memory serves, I think this is Gid Tanner and the Skillet Lickers.
Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. Gather all those equals up and herd them on the pier. America for white, Africa for black. Send those eggs back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. 20 million ugly cums already on the pier.
In there, man, I ain't gonna get on that boat. Look like that boat leaked to me, man. Oh, man, you're the best white man ever, but here I come.
America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. Boats are ready for the trip, we won't shed a tear.
Seems like nobody don't love us nice colored folks anymore. Oh, no.
America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. Hand that chimp his ugly stick, hand that buck his spear.
Just a minute there, man, I just got my bottle of wine back me on the dock. Oh, man!
America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. 20 million jigaboos, Africa will steer.
How we gonna find Africa, man? We ain't got no compass. How we gonna find that island, man? Oh,
America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. There they go, far out to sea, see them disappear.
Hello, hello back there on the dock. I believe this boat is leaking, man.
America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, White Man's Day is here. Boats are leaking badly now, the sink we saddle it fear.
Help! Help! Please take it out! Help!
America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, White Man's Day is here. No more niggers, civil rights led by nigger queer. America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, White Man's Day is here. Our homes, our schools, our cities, streets of niggers will be clear. America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, White Man's Day is here. America will be all white, the land we love so dear. America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ship those niggers back. Ship those niggers back. Ship those niggers back.
Now, speaking of small handheld items, during the music break I was checking my email, and I found to my delight that one of our comrades back east has created and sent me a superb new JPEG image of the Northwest Tricolor with a slogan on it, which I'll begin using and which I will send out to the list. This image would be great on a sticker or on one side of a postcard, for example. This is the kind of individual initiative I love to see in the NF. Thanks, Dan. Sometimes people ask me, Harold, what exactly is it that you want? What do you hope to achieve? Well, I'll show you.
Sons of Scotland, I am William Wallace.
William Wallace is 7 feet tall.
Yes, I've heard. He kills men by the hundred. And if he were here, he'd consume the English with fireballs from his eyes and bolts of lightning from his arse. I am William Wallace. And I see a whole army of my countrymen here in defiance of tyranny. You've come to fight as free men. And free men you are. What will you do with that freedom? Will you fight? We will live. Aye. Fight and you may die. Run and you'll live. At least a while. And dying in your beds many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives? But they'll never take our freedom!
What I want is someday to hear those words, or words to that effect, shouted out here in the Northwest, loud enough to be heard all the way to Washington, D.C. But right now, we basically need lone wolves, and by that I mean men and women who are capable of operating on their own. Coming to a primary settlement area is great. Everybody should do it. But realistically speaking, for many years, the Northwest Front representatives in large areas of the homeland will be scattered individuals. That's just the way it's working out. Now, we need strong, strong men and women of iron will and iron character, utterly dedicated and utterly determined, who can, if necessary, spend years at a time operating all alone out in the politically correct wilderness. If possible, we need people who don't need much human contact, or at least who can do without it as much as possible, because there is so little of it in the life of a white racial nationalist. Remember what I've told you before about reading John le Carré spy novels. We need people who have the nerves of steel and the power of mind over body and emotion to live and function for years as agents behind enemy lines. And in view of the fact that even the world's intelligence services have trouble locating and motivating and training and inserting that kind of individual and making them into effective assets, I suppose I shouldn't be surprised that we do as well. The fact is that we have enough followers right now so that if we can ever get the leaders in place, we'll be able to set up those cells and the support systems that they need. One of the worst things that three generations of Jewish materialism and luxury and brainwashing has done to white Americans is that they've managed largely to breed out of us that alpha gene that makes white men go first, be the pioneers and explorers and discoverers and leaders that so many of our ancestors were. The Daniel Boones and the Kit Carsons and the Brigham Youngs and the Lewis and Clarks that our race once produced in such abundance now seem almost to be extinct. White Americans have become soft as butter, and I don't just mean in the physical sense, although that's bad enough. We must once more become hard men in every sense of the word, willing to strike out on our own and homestead in the politically correct wilderness. Maybe you can think of your own Northwest migration in those terms. You're coming to a wild wasteland that is inhabited by all kinds of savages, and only a small number of settlers like yourselves. But once the trail is blazed, once someone else has gone first, then all the others will follow behind. And accepting this horrible world we live in as it is a terribly difficult thing to do. Living in a toilet that hasn't been flushed for almost a century is a terrible and poisonous way to exist, and naturally we all want out. That's why so many young white people seek to escape from it. Escape into internet games like World of Warcraft. Escape into drugs or booze or pointless lives of endless adolescence. To become a Northwest pioneer means growing up and taking on a man's responsibilities, and that's a hard choice for many young people to make. But it's the choice that you have to make if there's going to be any kind of future, not just for all the rest of us, but for you personally. Come on now, get serious. Let's really think about this. If you stay where you are, what kind of future awaits you? What do you think this country is going to be like in 10 or 20 or 30 years? I think most of you have some idea, at least in the backs of your minds, what you want out of life from now on. Now, how likely are you to get it if nothing changes? Yes, a new life and a new world can be yours, and yes, it's a dangerous undertaking. It requires risk and inconvenience and a lifelong commitment to a better way than we were born into. And many white people today can't handle that. You've been conditioned all your life not to be able to handle it because the Jews don't want you going anywhere. This foul system wants you to remain where you are as livestock to be sheared and milked and eventually slaughtered to put more food on the tables of those who rule us in one endless banquet that they make for themselves out of our blood and sweat and suffering. Come on, guys. Don't be livestock all your lives. Break out of the pen. Break away from the herd and head on your own into those Northwest woods. It'll be worth it. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Follow in their footsteps of the rising moon.